Otto's brother lived.
Perhaps miracles do happen.
Darkwood turned to Mann.
They are waiting for us, I think. Otherwise, they would have killed the young man.
I agree.
I do not think we should disappoint them, do you?
Mann's left eyebrow curled upward, something like a smile, but without the lips.
No, I think they're very deserving, and it would be a crime to let them get away from here without us touching base, so to speak. Showing them a little of your country's hospitality, which I, of course, look forward to myself.
Do you like strudel?
Yes, I think I do.
Mann nodded as if some great question were now resolved.
My wife made wonderful strudel. But it can't be had in the commercial bakeries. Not quite as good.
He looked away, all trace of a smile gone.
So much evil.
The snow fell in large, gentle flakes, the size of the silver Eisenhower dollars Darkwood saw in the pre-war coin display at the new Smithsonian at Midwake. Everything was gray, and Darkwood supposed the scenery reflected the mood. Darkwood turned around at the sound of activity behind him. Otto Hammerschmidt sat beside his brother as a tent went up around them. Sam Aldridge approached, came to attention, saluted. Darkwood let Colonel Mann return the salute.
Colonel, Captain, young Hammerschmidt confirms as best he can that it was some sort of energy weapon. I have no idea what.
Very good, Captain Aldridge.
Colonel Mann nodded, slipping back from his apparent reverie.
Then we should start at once to find it, and the men responsible for using it.
Very good, sir. Should I order the men to mount?
Leave an adequate force to defend the temporary camp. Captain Hammerschmidt can't be placed in command of the defense.
Begging the Colonel's pardon, sir, but Captain Hammerschmidt requested specifically to accompany any punitive expedition.
Darkwood watched Colonel Mann's eyes. They seemed to beam.
Select a junior officer, then. Would you concur, Captain Darkwood?
I would, Colonel.
Colonel Mann turned to face Sam Aldridge.
You have your orders then, Captain.
Yes, sir.
We leave in 3 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Aldridge saluted. Mann returned it. Aldridge jogged off through the snow.
Listen up, Marines and you German commandos, too. We're moving out. Lieutenant Klein.
Yes, sir, Captain.
Pick 11 men. You'll need 2 machine guns. Hobble the horses. Set up a defensive perimeter for 100 yards surrounding the tent and the remaining horses. Then set up a tailback line with secondary defensive positions at 25 yards. Be ready for anything. Keep your mortars behind the 25-yard limit.
Yes, sir, Captain.
He adapts to surface warfare well. Walk with me.
They started toward the horses.
I had read prejudiced accounts of American Marines, of course, as swaggering blowhards.
Well, they can be that, but you shouldn't try soliciting fair comments about the Marines from the Navy.
I think the accounts I read were grievously in error.
The Marines have always been tough and adaptable. They used to be called leathernecks. The story goes that during the early post-Revolutionary War days, they wore uniforms with leather collars. That's probably true, but I personally feel they're leathernecks because they're damned near indestructible. At least if the Marines of Midwake are anything like the Marines before the war.
Darkwood reached out his hand and touched Colonel Mann's forearm. Mann looked at him quizzically.
But do me a favor, Colonel. Never tell a Marine I ever said that. There's the honor of the Navy to be upheld.
Colonel Mann allowed a smile. They continued moving through the snow toward the horses. The 8 men had clearly lost track of her. She watched with curiosity as, still careful of their defensive posture, they conferred, arrived at a decision, then acted upon it. They split into 4 two-man groups to search for her. Natalia smiled inwardly and watched one of the teams. They made for the rocks, not knowing she was in the rocks, merely following their part of the search pattern. She promptly moved deeper into the rocks, leaving the security of her pre-selected niche, tightening the sling for her M16, since she could not employ it without alerting the other 6. Doubtless there were more of the Nazis lurking about near where she left Annie with the injured helicopter pilot used to draw the women from the retreat. Gunshots might trigger action there that could result in danger to Annie. Natalia moved as rapidly as prudence allowed there on the high rocks, with narrow ledges, ice-slicked and snow-covered. The climbing stick was her only means of testing a surface before trusting it for a footfall. Still, she was outdistancing the searchers easily. Sarah Rourke tromboned the action of the Remington 870 police shotgun. She had been exposed to a sufficient number of guns since the night of the war that she knew, in spite of herself, volumes of the little details that comprised much of the knowledge of the firearms cognoscenti. The fore end of the 12-gauge, for example, was from a Packmeyer kit, while the black synthetic pistol-gripped buttstock was from Choate. The leather shell carrier, apparently modified to fit the slender wrist of the buttstock, was from Milt Sparks. She tried to remember its model name.
Cold Comfort.
Maria Lloyden looked up from the book she was reading.
What did you say, Sarah? Cold Comfort?
I was thinking out loud. But I guess a gun can be cold comfort, can't it?
What are you reading?
Michael told me I should read the works of Ayn Rand.
She held up one of the philosopher and novelist's most famous and longest works.
1,084 pages in paperback.
What?
I read that in paperback. I didn't agree with it. John asked me to read it. I suppose I'd agree with it more now. I think you grew up on that book, the Boy Scout Manual, and Guns and Ammo magazine. Come to think of it, there are a lot of times out there.
She gestured toward the entrance of the retreat.
After the night of the war, before he found us, I wished I'd read those.
The Boy Scout Manual?
Sometimes more of Guns and Ammo.
Sarah began loading the 870's extended magazine with the German-made clones of Federal double-aught buckloads John kept for the shotgun. If something went wrong, and someone who shouldn't got into the retreat, it would be a shotgun job. Experience taught her that. Experience taught her a lot of things. As the nearest of the AV-16s rolled past them, Rourke, only his face partially out of the snow, spread his arms, slewing snow away from his body. He half fell as he broke into what passed for a run in nearly chest-deep snow, more a combination of lunging, falling, swimming, and trying to stand toward the nearly cruise ship-sized Soviet tactical missile launcher. He glanced left. Paul was just beside him. Soviet vehicles, the 35-foot-long armored personnel carriers, the impossibly huge T-91 tanks, and more of the AV-16 missile-launching platforms surrounded them. With the somewhat disorienting effect of the snowscape, the only thing that confirmed to John Rourke that the ATSAC and Michael hadn't been found on Soviet sensing equipment or collided with by mere chance was that there was no enemy fire. All of the Soviet battle vehicles moved onward across the plateau as though nothing could stop them. Up close, Rourke wondered if anything could. They kept running, falling into the snow, picking themselves up, running again. The AV-16 was almost past them. Its treads were John's immediate goal, so broad and so deeply ridged and so rugged that his plan might just work. And it was the only option they had. Rourke drew the Crane LS-10 knife. The shaft of yellow from one of the AV-16's running lights bathed the snow around them, the light glinting eerily in the 12 inches of blade steel of the LS-10. Paul drew the knife sheathed to his belt. The AV-16 mobile missile platform towered over them, its enormous gray bulk like a mountain moving along on tank treads. Rourke swam his way out of the snowdrift so high it was nearly to his throat. A storm of snow more intense than anything natural lashed around them, churned into a whirlwind by the movement of the AV-16s, the tanks, and the armored personnel carriers. Rourke threw himself toward the rearmost segment of the AV-16's left side forward track.
Now and never!
There was no way of telling if his friend could hear him. The LS-10, in both gloved fists, John hammered the blade into the massive tread. The blade bit deep. Rourke's entire body shook. His arms and shoulders were nearly wrenched from his body as the tank-like tread continued rotating. Huge clots of snow flung upward in its wake, half burying Rourke as he rode out of the snow. Rourke's chest, the entire front of his body, was slammed against the tread, driving the air out of him. The effect was like drowning, snow literally burying him as he was dragged up, lungs burning. He was prone on the tread, moving forward with such speed that in microseconds he would be dragged down, crushed beneath the tread as it bit into the snow. Natalia slipped the heavier outer glove into a side pocket of her parka, only the skin-tight silk glove liner remaining. Immediately, she began flexing her fingers to keep the circulation going. Years ago, centuries ago, when she adopted the balisong as her personal edged weapon, she realized that the ability to make it move as though it were some sort of living entity could be a vital asset in close combat. For the balisong to move quickly, it had to be barely touched, almost fly through the fingers. She could not try a practice opening or closing because the clicking sounds of steel to steel might be heard by the two Nazis who were mere yards from where she waited now to kill them. She heard the crunching of snow beneath heavy boots. She tucked back deeper into the wedge of rock where she hid, the balisong in her right-hand palm, her fingers still moving to keep them limber against the already numbing effect of the cold. Vladimir. A flood of bitter memories passed through her, and she was colder because of them. He even persecuted her in death. Her right hand that held the knife shook beyond trembling. She could hear the two Nazis, the telltale creaking of packs and small arms. In an instant, they would pass by and she would have to act or die. She might die even then. She saw them, their backs to her. But there was no moral dilemma. At the instant she opened the knife, unless they were deaf, they'd turn toward her. She counted on that. And the scarf over her mouth and nose, along with the snow goggles, would protect her from the blood. The knife came alive in her gloved hand. The nearer of the two men turned toward her, eyes wide beneath the snow goggles, visible in the light of the second man's flashlight. The Balisong's primary edge severed the man's exposed carotid. He fell as she involuntarily squinted against the blood spray. The second man was raising his assault rifle to fire. The Balisong cleaved down across the second man's throat, slowing as its primary edge encountered the collarbone beneath the right breast of the parka. He fell into the snow, the flashlight tumbling from dying fingers. Natalia stood there, holding the knife. Not a sound on the air beyond the rushing of the wind. There were tiny speckles on Natalia's snow goggles. She knelt beside the nearer of the two dead Nazis, wiping her blade clean on his coat, and then stood. Seconds was all it took. They were dead. She didn't know whether the thoughts that filled her were somehow evil, like the men she killed were evil, but she felt alive again.
I'm back.
Paul Rubinstein flew forward, dragged along the tread, wedged beneath the fender guarding it, the back of his parka ripping, his M16 caught in it. The Schmeisser lashed to his chest, squeezing him in, denying him breath. He fought to move, wanted to shout, had no breath. He tore his knife free as the tread dragged him forward. There was a snap as the sling for his M16 ripped away. He clung to the knife, reached out. Something had him, powerful, vice-like. His left arm swung up and out. He was hanging, swinging like a marionette on one uncertain string. Paul looked up. He stared into the face of John Rourke. John jacked Paul up and onto the AV-16's ice-slicked superstructure. Darkwood sat with his back straight, feeling the motion of the horse, Fritz, beneath him, but aware of it only on the very edge of his consciousness. On his right rode Colonel Wolfgang Mann. On his left, Otto Hammerschmidt rode astride a strapping animal colored nearly like the Palomino Roy Rogers always rode. Their German assault rifles lay across the fronts of their saddles.
We're idiots!
Yes.
For a good cause!
Four of us and God knows how many of them!
I am glad this God you refer to knows, Captain Aldridge. But I wish he would share his intelligence data with us.
They moved along a narrow defile, wide enough only for the four of them to ride.
Maybe it wasn't such a good idea I had after all, Colonel.
Well, now's a really great time to think about that, Sam.
It was brilliant. They know it is a trap of sorts, yet they can't resist killing four officers. And they feel tactically superior with a new weapon. If we survive, I shall recommend you to your General Gonzalez, your Marine Corps Commandant, for a medal. If we do not, well...
Hammerschmidt laughed for the first time since news of his brother's possible death and the realization that the younger Hammerschmidt miraculously survived. Jason Darkwood eased the Lancer 2418A2 in its holster, his eyes on the rocky overhangs flanking them on either side as they rode into the pass. He thought about his Western movies again.
Gary Cooper, eat your heart out.
They solved the problem of Paul's coat as soon as they entered the AV-16 through an aft service hatchway and were spotted by an elite corpsman guard. Rourke shot the guard once in the head with a suppressor-fitted Smith & Wesson 6906 9mm. Rourke manually cycled the action, reapplying the slide lock, as Paul shifted into the coat over his already empty DeSantis slant shoulder rig. Pain etched across Paul's face as he pulled the coat closed.
Not a bad feat, John.
Lucky for him he didn't die for nothing.
They moved forward, the smell of synth fuel residue strong on the air, blue wisps of smoke like fog around them. Despite the fact that synth fuel residue was not harmful to inhale, the experience was nonetheless nauseating. Rourke and Rubinstein moved past the 6x6 by 8-foot, nearly cube-shaped tool storage area and into one of the narrow tunnels at its far end. None of the tunnels was wider than the shoulder span of a healthy-sized man. Rourke glanced at his old friend. Despite the battering Paul's body took, he seemed all right. Rourke promised himself to carefully examine Paul for any sign of injury at the first opportunity after they got out of this. In Paul's right hand was the German MP-40 submachine gun. In his left, the Browning high-power 9mm. The second Browning would still be under Paul's coat, probably chamber empty, just stuffed into his trouser belt. The tunnel extended some 10 feet, stopped at a round door, locked with the type of mechanism usually employed on the watertight doors of submarines and surface warfare vessels. There was a synth rubber gasket surrounding the flange.
In the event of a gas attack?
Yeah, likely the reason.
Rourke reached out his left hand to try the wheel-shaped lock. It moved, and relatively easily. He left it closed.
Probably troop quarters. A dozen or so.
Probably.
Rourke stuffed the suppressor-fitted 9mm under his coat, weighing the possibilities.
Like always?
Sure. With this all-metal structure, we could kill ourselves with the ricochets.
That's what I was thinking. Pistols, right?
Safer in the long run. Accurate shooting is better shooting.
Paul safed his submachine gun, shifted the older high power into his pocket for a moment, extracted the second one, worked the slide, settled in his left hand, hammer cocked, the safety off. He took the older gun in his right hand and lowered the Browning safety. John's coat was already open, the two scoremasters wedged between his belt and his sweater-covered abdomen. He shifted them slightly.
Ready?
Yeah.
Rourke smiled. He spun the wheel fast, the locking bolts slid out of their receptacles. Rourke wrenched the wheel to full open. He shoved the door in as he stepped over the flange. Both hands pulled pistols as he scanned the chamber beyond the doorway. Six men were lying in smallish bunks racked along the sides of the 10-foot-wide cell-like structure that comprised living quarters for the defensive team personnel. Eight more men, he and Paul miscalculated, were either sitting on the edges of the shelf-like cots or around a small bolted-down table at the exact center of the room, along which, on both sides, were similarly constructed bolted-down benches.
Comrades.
For an instant, no one moved. Then one of the elite corpsmen reached for a pistol on the table near his right hand. Everyone moved at once. Both scoremasters were empty, slides locked open. Rourke didn't draw the twin combat masters from the double Alessi shoulder holster under his parka. There was no need.
I still got 12 rounds.
Rourke nodded, then started to change magazines. In a moment, more enemy personnel would be coming. Natalia risked her radio.
Annie, can you hear me?
I'm reading you.
She asked for the code phrase they'd agreed upon, something they'd both felt no man would trip to.
Did you start?
I feel a little bloated. Any time now.
Natalia smiled. The code response meant Annie was free to talk, not under an enemy weapon.
I have to keep my voice low. There were 8 men. Now there aren't that many. There may be as many surrounding you. Be even more careful than you were. How is our charge?
He's alive. I don't know for how much longer.
This won't be much longer. Out.
Natalia set hers and Annie's radios to a frequency neither employed by the Germans nor the Russians. If all frequencies were being scanned, the transmission might have been picked up, otherwise not likely. She would bank on the latter, but if the transmission were intercepted, it made little difference. There were enemy personnel yet to kill before she could even hope to go back for Annie. Time, and the young German pilot's life, were running out. Natalia pouched the radio and started moving again through the deep snowdrifts. The high wind obliterated her tracks as soon as she made them. She knew these mountains reasonably well. The enemy personnel could not. And none of them, but one, perhaps, was as good as she was. It wasn't conceit, merely fact. And that one, this Rausch person, would stay back until the last. Their horses moved in single file. Wolfgang Mann at the head of the short column, Jason Darkwood behind him, then Otto Hammerschmidt, followed by Sam Aldridge. A second ago, Darkwood thought he saw movement in the rocks to their right and slightly above them. But it could also have been a trick of his imagination. Both Sam and Otto were in radio contact with the remaining 20 men of their force, 10 behind them at the base of the long defile, through which they rode now for some time, and 10 who by now should have reached their destination on the far end of the defile. When the KGB Elite Corps unit struck, Sam and Otto would signal for the two 10-man elements to close in. Then it would merely be a matter of holding on until help arrived. At most, as Colonel Mann assessed it after Sam Aldridge proposed the plan, 5 minutes at a gallop. The J-7Vs were on call as well. They would reach the site of any ambush in under 3 minutes. Jason tried to feel reassured, but 5 minutes, or even 3 minutes, could be a terribly long time, long enough certainly to die. Colonel Mann's horse moved ahead. The V-shaped stream bed through which they rode rose sharply and flared out dramatically into rippling waves of snow-splotched granite. It was almost possible again for two men to ride abreast. And if the Soviet force were going to attack, they would attack now.
If they're gonna hit us...
Darkwood averted his eyes, feeling rock chips pelting him after a wash of heat blew across them like a wind. His horse, Fritz, reared. Darkwood nearly lost his rifle as he clung with both hands to the animal's mane and the pommel of the military saddle. The horse slipped as the second blast came, showering man and animal alike in suddenly melted snow, turned to steam, and a blinding spray of rock chips and dust. Only Darkwood's snow goggles saved his eyes as he and his rifle plummeted from the saddle. Jason hit the side of the rock wall and skidded down, catching himself as conventional automatic weapons fire laced across the granite inches from him. Wedging his boot heels against the rock ledge, he drew his pistol, returning fire. Sam Aldridge's Palomino bolted past Darkwood, Aldridge clinging to the saddle with both hands, his assault rifle slung across his back, his feet dragging over the icy granite defile. Darkwood glanced right. Otto Hammerschmidt, horse under perfect control when Hammerschmidt's left foot stomped on the reins, was half-crouched, firing upwards into the rocks. There was a flash of light. Instinctively, Darkwood dodged. The granite, less than a yard from where he had been, exploded in a shower of steam and dust and rock chips, obscuring everything for an instant. The damn energy weapon. In the snow at the dead center of the defile lay Darkwood's assault rifle. He started for it. Another blast from the energy weapon vaporized the rifle and the rock around it. Darkwood edged back.
Sam!
I'm all right! Got you covered, Chase! Run for it!
Darkwood didn't think twice. He turned in a dead run for the sound of Aldridge's voice. His left sleeve ripped. He felt a crease of pain on the outside of his right thigh. Mann was firing from horseback. His animal reared suddenly as conventional small arms fire cut a ragged swath across the rocky surface near its forelegs. Mann half fell, half leapt from the saddle, his assault rifle in his hands as he crashed to his knees, rolled, and fired. Then he was up and running. Darkwood could see Sam Aldridge crouched in the rocks where the defile widened, his horse dead in the snow beside him, blank eyes staring at nothing. Assault rifle fire tore into the animal's body, making it lurch as though somehow reanimated. Darkwood's own horse was racing toward him. Jason pulled himself up from the ground, reached out, threw himself toward the animal, and held on. Natalia waited the better part of 10 minutes for the orders to be given for the 6 remaining men in the immediate vicinity of the retreat to reassemble after fruitless attempts at contacting by radio the 2 men she had murdered. Now it would have to be very quick, and there would be no second chances. Because if it didn't work, she would be fully exposed to 6 assault rifles and have only 2 six-shot revolvers for defense against them. That would not be enough. There wouldn't even be time to reach the suppressor-fitted Walther 380 beneath her coat. Her own assault rifle and the rifles of the 2 dead men would not help either, because she would have to walk into the thing barehanded. She learned the technique from John. In these days, and in those days 5 centuries ago, no one expected to be braced in a stand-up gunfight as in the era of the American Wild West, face-to-face, live or die.
I have to come talk with you. I am without a rifle. My hands are empty.
The 6 men turned to face her as one. She hadn't lied, after all, because her hands were empty, and her rifle and the rifles of the 2 dead men were hidden back in the rocks. So were her holsters, but not the belt she usually wore them on. The belt was cinched around her waist over her sweater. The twin stainless L-frame Smith 357s were stuffed into the belt, in the front, just the way John did it with his scoremasters. If she could pull it off the way John did, she'd live, maybe.
I am coming out to speak with you. We have you surrounded, and we wish to discuss terms for your surrender.
She kept her hands well away from her body plane, so they'd be visible. She was counting on audacity, too, the sheer audacity of proclaiming that the 6 heavily armed men were surrounded by a group of women. One of the 6 took a short step forward, raising his assault rifle to hip level.
Fire a single burst, and before I fall, there will be more gunfire from the rocks surrounding you than you can imagine.
It sounded rather lame, especially in intentionally clumsy German, but in a way, that could be good. The more overconfident the 6 men felt, the easier they would be to deal with.
Which is your leader?
The one who stepped slightly forward raised his chin.
I command this patrol. Our leader has your friend surrounded. She will die at the slightest provocation.
There was a possibility, of course, however remote, that upon hearing gunfire and after attempting radio contact with these 6, the men near Annie's position would simply do their best to kill her immediately. But with these 6 alive, the situation had no hope at all. She stopped when she was 30 feet from the 6 men. They were bunched up tightly, which was better for her.
Will you lay down your weapons and surrender?
The leader turned to look at the other 5. Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna reached for her guns. Jason Darkwood leaned hard over the neck of his horse, the animal vaulting ahead along the trail toward the height overlooking the defile within which his comrades still fought for their lives. The hood of Darkwood's parka blew back, and he ripped the navy blue stocking cap from his head, the wind lashing across his face. He lashed at the animal with the reins, kicking his heels against its flanks, spurring Fritz up along the ice-slicked granite. The energy weapon fired again. He couldn't see the flash, nor the resultant explosion, but he could feel the concussion almost simultaneously with the blast. The Lancer 2418A2 was still held tight in his right fist. He made it that there were 9 or 10 rounds remaining in the pistol, reminding himself he should count his pistol shots as carefully as he counted the torpedoes aboard his submarine, the Reagan.
Yeah! Come on, boy! Come on!
Fritz ran along the flatter rock bed toward the bend just ahead. Fritz's hind feet slipped on the ice. The animal nearly went down, regained its balance, then ran to the bend.
Yeah!
Fritz reared. Darkwood nearly lost his balance, but managed to hang on.
All right, Fritz.
Fritz bolted around the corner. The trail opened up into a wide ledge, the perfect spot for cannon to rain death on the plain below. Arrayed before the horse and rider with a detail of 6 Spetsnaz guards, the most bizarre weapon Jason Darkwood ever saw, and its crew. Darkwood saw terror in the faces of the energy weapon gun crew. Before the guards could react, Jason clamped Fritz's reins in his teeth and filled his hands. Darkwood threw himself from the saddle as Fritz reared and stood before the energy weapon. What looked like an oversized coaxial cable ran from the rear of the gun to some piece of unidentifiable machinery. Jason pulled his own version of a Bowie knife from his belt and hacked down. The cable severed. Darkwood grabbed the pistol grip of the energy weapon. It was about the size of a conventional machine gun, though awkward for one man to lift up. The burning sensation creased his ribcage, then went cold as he hurtled the energy weapon over the edge of the abyss toward the snow-splotched granite below. As men swarmed over him, he thought he heard the sound of German J-7Vs coming over the horizon, but the horizon was lost in darkness. Annie sensed movement around her. Whether it was her 5 normal senses or something more, she knew they were coming. She knew Rausch was coming. She checked the wounded German flyer's pulse. It was nearly too weak to detect. She clicked on her communicator.
Natalia, if you can hear me, they're coming.
If Natalia was very near, she might well have the radio turned off so an incoming transmission would not betray her position. The units could be worn with earpieces, but they were uncomfortable at best, and in the cold weather even worse. And if Natalia heard, she might be unable to respond without betraying her position. At any event, there was no answer. Annie unwrapped herself and the soldier sufficiently from the blankets that she could wriggle out. She covered him quickly, leaving only his mouth and a portion of his nose exposed. She was instantly colder. Her rifle beside her, she clambered over 2 seat backs and crawled on hands and knees toward the farthest edge of the helicopter wreckage. She kept moving along the edge of the wreckage toward the spot just aft of the gutted cockpit. It would be the best defensive position. From this vantage point, she had a 270-degree field of vision. The remaining 90 degrees in bits and pieces were irreconcilable blind spots. She removed her heavy outer glove, pressing it under her armpit to keep it closed and seal the body heat within. She reached to her waist, opened the M12 holster, and pulled the Detonic Scoremaster 45. The Beretta 92F she carried in the other holster had a higher firepower potential, to be sure, but if she needed a pistol at all, it would be at very close range, and the 45 ACP round was deadlier to her way of thinking. Annie edged the slide slightly back to visually confirm a chambered round. The press check completed, she reholstered, this time cocked and locked. There was a sudden movement from far to her right, and she had the M16 to her shoulder in the same instant, aware that her glove had fallen to the snowdrift that covered a portion of the cockpit doorframe.
Fraulein Rock!
The man had a white flag tied to the muzzle of an M16. She smiled, wondering who it might have been who gave it to him. Maybe Commander Dodd of Eden Base.
It's Frau Rubinstein!
I prefer your other name, Fraulein. I should not like to have to think of you as a Jew.
Rather my husband's a Jew than a damn Nazi like you.
There was no response for an instant, only the howl of the wind. But the man with the white flag didn't move to cover. She retrieved her glove and pocketed it.
Very well, Frau Rubinstein. My name is Hugo Gedler. I have been empowered by my superiors to offer you safety if you will surrender to me at once. Otherwise, you will be shot.
She didn't bother answering.
Frau Rubinstein, this is the last time I will ask you.
Well, thank God for small favors.
The man who identified himself as Hugo Gerdler walked back into cover. Annie tucked down as well as she could. The German aviator was protected by an aggregation of assorted pieces of heavy debris from the gunship, walled in with steel and charred seat cushions, as safe as she could make him when the shooting started. Michael Rourke's eyes burned and his temples throbbed, but he could barely risk blinking his eyes. He had to keep them focused on the electronics displays before him. The last of the Soviet AV-16 missile platforms, with its entourage of monstrously large T-91 tanks and armored personnel carriers, was rolling past him. According to the display and the feelings in his guts, one of the T-91s was less than a yard from him. He could feel the ground vibrate beneath the ATSAC. Was the snow covering the ATSAC shaking off? If it was, and someone aboard the passing vehicles noticed, he was dead. All that saved the ATSAC from electronic recognition was the metallic mass of the armored armada surrounding him. Just too many signals to interpret, even assuming the Soviet electronics were backed by computers as sophisticated as the system aboard the ATSAC. Visual recognition was another matter. If the snow was gone, the ATSAC would be impossible to miss. The T-91 nearest him rumbled past, without slowing, without altering course. As his own danger began to pass, his mind began to fill with thoughts of his father and his brother-in-law and friend, Paul, aboard one of the gigantic AV-16 tactical missile launchers, if they weren't already dead. John and Paul moved through a rust-brown-colored tube, its air clouded with noxious-smelling gray-blue wisps of synth-fuel residue like Hell's Boiler Factory. Rourke's eyes narrowed as he neared the AV-16's control cabin, a Detonic Scoremaster 45 held tight in each fist, the guns along his thighs, hammers cocked, the respective thumbs of his right and left hands poised over the ambidextrous safeties, ready to drop them. Paul, a Browning high power in each fist, nodded toward the blue, smoky blackness behind them. John Rourke glanced that way and nodded back. There were new sounds, faint sounds of booted feet moving along the tunnel. They were trapped. Rourke stuffed both pistols into his trouser band beneath the open parka. He moved his hands along the ceiling of the tunnel, over the access panel. What it provided access to, he didn't know, only hoped. Four thumb screws held the panel in place. As Paul moved deeper back, ready to meet the men coming along the tunnel, John unscrewed the panel. The clanking boots were louder now, closer. Rourke removed the panel and stared into a maze of plasticized tubes and three gauges. The AV-16s ran synth fuel to power a closed steam system that turned the massive turbines needed to propel it and provide for the massive amounts of electrical energy needed. It took a lot of steam. John signaled into the smoke-filled corridor, hoping Paul could see him. Rourke studied the three gauges intently. One was an emergency bypass. He turned the knob beside the gauge, and pressure immediately began to drop. He turned back to normal pressure. The next gauge, and the handle below it, monitored and controlled recirculating steam. As best Rourke could tell, the third processed incoming steam, directing it along an emergency routing system and through the main system.
Six men. We start shooting, we'll alert the crew in the compartment there.
Rourke looked at his friend as Paul nodded toward the control room.
I think I've got that under control. Be ready to get through that doorway into the control compartment as fast as you can.
John turned the knob on the emergency bypass control. He checked the main system route for the steam. If he split the pipe in just the right way, it was only the modern equivalent of PVC.
Be ready. Have your flashlight ready, Paul. Better zip up and pull your hood as close around your face as possible. Don't leave any more exposed skin than necessary. Hands too.
The two men pulled up their hoods, zipped and tightened their clothes, then pulled on their gloves. John pulled the life support system 10 knife. He turned his face toward the tunnel space behind them.
Goggles.
Even with the precautions, if he miscalculated, he and Paul would be boiled by the live steam.
Ready.
Through the swirls of smoke, the details swept into view.
Run for your lives!
John stabbed the LS-10 into the pipe, leaving the knife there to release a high-pressure cloud of steam into the faces of their pursuers.
I've got the door!
The lights blinked out in the next instant. A red panic light flashed on, illuminating the tunnel as it filled with steam. John and Paul held their breath and barreled through the doorway to the control room.
Don't move!
But the crewmen of the control cabin were already moving, stumbling in the darkness that was relieved only by two pinpoint panic lights set in the low ceiling. John and Paul didn't wait for them to load their guns. Rourke's flashlight beam swept over the room.
You left!
Rourke sidestepped right as he spun left. Flashlight and 45 moved as one, blinding an elite corpsman.
Paul! Get get this thing under control! I'm killing this demon, restoring power! Then I'll lock us in! Right!
Rourke rammed the nearly empty Scoremaster into his trousers and grabbed the second pistol as he reached the door. A man, recognizable only by the uniform and the gun, lay on the tunnel floor near the doorway, nothing human-looking left to his red, raw face and hands. John stepped over the body and drew up his goggles. The beam of the flashlight he carried in his belt swept crazily over the ceiling of the tunnel. Rourke pulled both gloves onto his right hand. He'd burn himself, most likely. He held the flashlight in his left hand and reached his right into the steam from as far behind its jet as he could. Pain seized him as his double-gloved hand penetrated the spray. He closed his fingers over the emergency bypass control and turned it. John yanked the life support system 10 out of the pipe, stumbled over the flange into the control room, and pulled the door to.
John!
The normal lighting had returned, and the contrast to the hell-like exterior nearly blinded Rourke as he stared past Paul Rubenstein. The AV-16's maneuvering controls were shot to pieces. They could be rewired. He looked at the view screens, but not in time. Less than 4 minutes, and the AV-16 would roll over the edge of the plateau.
Give me a hand, Paul. Fast!
What do you want me to do?
See if you could bring up the locations of the rest of the vehicles in the squadron.
Right.
Rourke crossed the compartment to what appeared to be the main computer console and sat down at the keyboard. He began typing access names. Missile targeting brought up the program he wanted as the seconds ticked away.
John! Got all the vehicles I can find located. Might have missed one, but I don't think so. And we don't have Michael in the ATSEC, that's certain.
Hang on.
Rourke scanned the program. He had it.
Try this sequence. A-19, C-6, F-13, W-3, K-5. What do you got?
Bingo! She's running!
Rourke's eyes left the green screen for the computer console, the whirring of the drives grinding in harmony. He shifted his gaze to the heads-up on the view screens. Each vehicle Paul located appeared on the view screen by its sensor impression with a target designation, one after the other. There was probably an override program that would allow the AV-16 in which they rode to target itself, but no time was left to find that. And the fall over the plateau would obliterate this machine at any event.
Can you launch?
Paul looked at him.
They couldn't be.
They aren't nuclear. I got that out of the program. High explosive anti-tank.
Rourke smiled, then moved to the door, his right hand stiffening, the skin cracking, as he moved it within his glove. He pulled the glove away.
Where are you going?
Rourke glanced at the view screens. About 2 minutes remained until the AV-16 rolled over the edge of the plateau. Rourke doused his right hand with the German antiseptic healing spray.
To the turret! I'll get the particle beam weapon and go out through there. Soon as you have those missiles launched, get the hell out of here. I'll see you on the outside.
Rourke didn't wait for an answer. He threw open the door and shoved a fresh magazine up the well of the nearly emptied Scoremaster, the second 45, one round fired, still in his waistband. He ran along the tunnel now toward the center of the vehicle, ticking off the seconds in his head. Rourke rounded the bend and neared the approximate center of the AV-16 and spotted an overhead hatchway. He wheeled it open, then pushed the hatch up and climbed. He loosened his M16 on its sling and flung the weapon through the hatchway opening. Rourke launched up through the opening. About 52 seconds remained before the AV-16 went over the precipice. An elite corpsman sat in a reclining seat, synchronized to turret movement of the energy weapon. A second man, a gunner's assistant of some kind, stood crouched beside a small control panel. Both men had pistols in their hands. Rourke saved both pistols as he spun toward the hatchway, kicking it shut. John reached to the floor, grabbed up the M16, the buttstock penetrated several times by pistol shots. He wedged the rifle's barrel over the hatchway door. 25 seconds at the outside. Rourke went to the energy weapon and studied the mount system, a simple push-through bolt secured with a large cotter pin. Rourke tore the cotter pin free, then pushed out the bolt. He wrenched the heavy weapon free of the mount. A cable fed down from the cannon through the mount. 20 seconds. Rourke glanced overhead. The bubble of the gun turret was partially cocooned in titanium or something like it. The interior covering looked like plexiglass.
I hope it's plexiglass.
Rourke pulled on his gloves. The cable extending from the gun was well insulated. He pulled out the LX-10 and hacked. Rourke grabbed the live end of the cable and held it to the dome. The surge of energy ignited the dome. Instantly, flaming chunks fell from the turret. Grabbing the energy weapon with his right hand and arm, Rourke reached his gloved hand into the flames. Catching hold of the titanium cocoon, he hauled himself up and through, catching his parka on fire. Rourke stumbled through the opening and down to the shell of the AV-16, wind tearing at him, snow blinding him. He squinted against it as he rolled across the armored missile platform's hull. Tube hatches were open, steam and vapor rose from them. Mass launch of the platform's missile complement was imminent as he rolled his body, trying to extinguish the flames. He looked forward. The AV-16 neared the abyss. His parka still aflame, the energy weapon clutched to his chest. John Rourke pushed himself up and jumped, flames all but consuming the sleeves of his parka, the legs of his snow pants. The roaring of the launching missiles numbed him as John plummeted through empty space. John slammed into something that filled his mouth. It was snow. Rourke burrowed into the drift and listened as the missiles found their marks. The ground shook beneath him. He tried to look up but could not, forced down by concussive force of explosion after explosion as the missiles reached the targets clustered around him, followed by secondary explosions as the weapons within the armored vehicles of the Soviet assault force themselves exploded. The ground seemed to break away from him. Snow showered down on him. The flames were gone from Rourke's clothes. The explosions kept coming. Jason Darkwood opened his eyes.
You are a brave man, Darkwood.
Wolfgang Mann smiled. Darkwood looked past Mann, seeing Sam Aldridge, left arm in a field sling, a silly grin on his face. Beside Sam, Otto Hammerschmidt. There was a look of satisfaction in Hammerschmidt's blue eyes.
Did we win?
You won, Captain. We only finished your work.
Darkwood felt a little sick to his stomach and lightheaded at the same time. He looked around him. He was inside a J-7V. He was lying down.
You're gonna be fine, Jace.
Sam Aldridge leaned over him, holding Darkwood's hands in his.
You saved all our lives, and when we saw you pitching that damn energy weapon, we thought you were a goner. They did, anyway. Me? I knew you'd come out on top. You're banged up, maybe got some cracked ribs, got a few bullets that zigged when you zagged, but you're okay, Jace.
There was something important Darkwood wanted to ask, and he remembered.
Fritz. The horse.
Sorry, Jace.
John couldn't hear Paul, but he could see Paul's lips moving. There was a roaring in his ears. He knew it would subside. The snow still fell, but there was a ring of fire surrounding them as Rourke lay there in the snow. Paul knelt beside him. The flames, Rourke realized, were from the synth fuel stores of the Soviet armored vehicles the missiles destroyed. In time, they would die out. Rourke sat up, shaky. He was wrapped in an emergency blanket. He assumed Paul could hear him.
Was I burned badly? I feel all right, but I can't hear you yet, so nod.
Paul smiled and shook his head in the negative.
I wasn't burned badly?
Paul nodded this time. He would have asked about Michael, but coming toward them from the furthest edge of the most distant arc of flames was the Atsak.
Did we win?
Paul Rubinstein smiled and nodded. Rourke looked at his friend. Paul Rubinstein was laughing, and it was like watching a silent movie, only the gesture, not the sound. Rourke felt himself starting to smile. The energy weapon lay in the snow beside him. With the plans Vasily Prokopyev struggled to bring to the Allies, now there was a chance against the new Soviet technology. There were five men surrounding Annie, closing in on her position in an ever-tightening circle. As carefully as she could, Natalia scouted the surrounding terrain before assuming her position in the rocks above the road that fronted the field in which the gutted helicopter lay. There had been no sign of anyone beyond these five. All of them were heavily armed, but that was to be expected. Sporadic firing began against the helicopter where Annie stood watch over the wounded German aviator. Natalia brought the M16 to her shoulder as answering fire came from Annie's position. A good, accurate rifle, a Dragunov, which she'd cut her rifle marksmanship teeth with, or a Steyr-Mannlicher SSG like John used, would have been better suited to the task at hand. As the five men advanced, Natalia settled the M16 comfortably. Annie began again to return fire, short bursts from the 30-round magazine. One man down, another man to Annie's fire. Another to Natalia's. Poorly aimed shots tore into the rocks surrounding Natalia, but she kept her spot there. No time to move. She fired again, another of the five men down. Now only two remaining. A fusillade of fire erupted from Annie's position. Natalia emptied her magazine, changed quickly to another, and unleashed a steady stream of short full-auto bursts. Steam rose from the barrel of her rifle as snow melted from it. Five men down. The firing from Annie's position stopped, as did Natalia's. Natalia took her radio from her pocket.
Annie, stay put for a while until we are sure. Do you read me?
Thank God you came. I'll stay put. He's still alive, so we can't sit it out for too long.
I think we have them all.
Friedrich Rausch watched the two women. On an improvised travois, slipping over the snow like a heavy-laden sled, He had seen these in photographs from the days of glory in the true Germany, lay a body. It would be the traitorous and expendable pilot from Wolfgang Mann's command. If the pilot lived to enter the retreat of Dr. Rourke, the man would die soon thereafter. But the two women were going to the retreat of Dr. Rourke. That was the important thing. Hugo Girdler turned to Rausch.
Your plan is working, Friedrich. But it was wrong that 13 of my men should die.
You know the plan. You approve the plan. Do not summon the rest of your force until we see them begin to enter.
I sometimes think you forget, Friedrich, that you are under my command.
And I sometimes think you forget, Hugo, that I do your dirty work so well.
Friedrich Rausch returned his gaze to the two women as they struggled along the road toward a peculiarly shaped mountain in the distance. Survivalist Firestorm is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1990, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Mort Shelby, Dylan Lynch, Michael Glenn, Nanette Savard, Ren Casey, Eric Messner, Christopher Graybill, M.B. Van Dorn, Stephen Carpenter, Thomas Penny, Johann Detweiler, David Coyne, Tom Simpson, Elizabeth Jernigan, Sonny Lasky, and Colleen Delaney. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Timothy Lynch. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Patton and Brian Rogers. Adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. With original music by Brian Patton, Matt Webb, and Nathaniel Perry. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for Ryder Stacy's Doomsday Warrior, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Edge of the Seat thriller in Graphic Audio.
The following preview is of a Graphic Audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Cadet Vada.
Sir.
You are a disgrace to the service.
Sir?
Many, many people want your head on a pike. I'm going to see your resignation on my desk by 1500 hours this afternoon.
I, Kailara Evangeline Dominique Vada, hereby resign from the Academy for personal reasons.
Now we have to figure out what to do with
you. Dad, listen.
We're sending you out to the Rift with a ship going to salvage. You're taking the Glennis Jones to Lastway.
You're making me captain?
Courage, Kai. You've got what you need to start a good life. Go.
What if I can make enough in trade to buy Glennis and fix her up and own my own ship?
I need to talk to you.
What's up?
We have a contract to deliver a cargo of agricultural machinery to Belinta. What?
Kai. We wondered how long it'd take.
Trade and profit, right? Well, let's take a look at this contract you signed. We have to buy the goods up front?
Of course. I thought Sabine Prime. Sabine has several manufacturers of the kind of equipment they want.
Well, it's worth trying.
Mandatory repairs. We have to replace that sealed unit.
Secundus has threatened to blockade Prime.
Prime and Secundus are moving towards war this time.
Sabine's system is now cut off from regular communication with the rest of the universe.
We have a problem. Warships. Get us away from the station, Riel.
Glennis Jones, acknowledge.
Captain Vada, Glennis Jones.
Glennis Jones, this is the Mackenzie Military Assistance Corporation ship Victor. You will proceed alone down the escape passage to the lock. You will operate the lock for our boarding personnel. You will obey the orders of their commanding officer. If you disobey, your ship is toast. Got that?
You're Captain Vada?
Yes.
Start back up the passage. Tell him to sit down on the deck, hands on knees.
Where's Skeldon?
He was here a second ago.
Skeldon!
Pit to Victor. Send me a medic. Live, damn it.
From Elizabeth Moon, creator of the Serrano Legacy, a compelling new sci-fi series, Vata's War. Book 1, Trading in Danger, Part 1, in graphic audio. If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series, available only at www.graphicaudio.net.